Our topic is Living with Prosperity, Options for Rich World Christians. Three quotes occurred to me, and I'd like to read them. One is from Gandhi, and I think I've got this accurately, but I'm not certain it's word for word the way it's supposed to be. The world has enough for everyone's need, but not enough for everyone's greed. Often quoted statement by Gandhi. There's a card up in the bookstore that I saw this afternoon. Again, a statement that has been floating around quite a bit. Live simply that others may simply live. And a third from Jesus, his statement of the rich young ruler, sell all that you have and give it to the poor and come and follow me. Now, what are we to do with these kinds of statements? Here we are in a world in which hundreds of millions of people are in desperate poverty. Poverty to the point of not even being able to nourish themselves and their families properly. What do we as Christians in the rich world do about this besides feel guilty? What's right and what's wrong in terms of the way we use wealth that is at our disposal? Where do we draw the line? How do we use the resources that God has entrusted to us? It's really a stewardship question. To kick off the comment tonight, Joel Muggy and Dave Mazenbring, who both spent time in parts of the world, Joel, case of Joel in Latin America, case of Dave in Africa, parts of the world where some of the extreme poverty that we all know exists is very prevalent. So with that, Joel, why don't you start off and tell us, you know, what do you think about some of these questions?
My as you were sharing the quotes that you were sharing, Art, one of the things that hit me again, and simply a statement I want to make that I think ought to be in our consciousness as we think about this issue, is while I very much support the ideas of taking steps to live simply, to live with less, it must always be a part of our consciousness, I think, that we have the choice to do that. For us, it is the choice. It may be the choice to live more simply, to live with less, and that in itself is something that separates us from much of the rest of the world. Coming to grips, first of all, with that fact that we have the choice, I think is an important starting point. I get, when people come back from Latin America and many of the experiences that we're involved with, this question keeps coming again and again and again and again. What can I do? I think many times for us North Americans, we ask the question, what can I do? We keep asking that question because we don't like what we know we can do or what we should do. So we want somebody to tell us something else that we could do that might be a little bit easier. I think a starting point, at least for most of us, is a continual openness to learning about the reality of people in the rest of the world. A woman last week in one of my sessions, in a very honest statement, said, I don't want to hear about this. It makes me sick to my stomach. I just don't want to hear any more about this. I mean, she did. She kept coming, but it was that feeling that I just don't want to hear about people's suffering. And I think one of our first tasks, and one of the things we can do is to continue to put ourselves in situations where we can learn, to struggle with other people in the world. And the more we do that, I think some natural responses will evolve. I think we will be drawn into responses that we can't even help. It seems to me that as North American Christians and as rich Christians, we certainly can and should continue to share our money, our resources, with those who are in need. But it may be important for us to understand those acts in a context. The phrases that I use to describe that are acts of survival. Giving money to people who need food, giving clothes, doing all the things that responding to people's human needs. But I think it's important to recognize that in those kinds of acts of charity alone, we are not changing the conditions that are at the root cause of the suffering of people in the world. And so that we engage in those acts of survival simply because they help some people survive in the meantime. But that there is a need for us to really begin to work at discovering what are some more actions, things that we can do that can help get at root causes of the kind of suffering that exists in the world. One of those may be, to give you an example that many people are talking about in this country, is to really confront the kind of money and resources that are going into militarization in this country, and what that means in terms of taking resources from issues of hunger and poverty in the world. We somehow try to look at what are ways in which we can begin to direct our lives in getting at some of those root causes. That may mean for many of us taking some real risks. It may mean, as in the cases, one of the areas where the Lutheran Church is starting to become involved, is the whole area of refugee sanctuary for Salvadoran refugees. Again, that's even almost a kind of act of survival, to keep some people safe. And yet it's also beginning to confront some of the basic policy issues that I think are at the root of some of the poverty and suffering we see in the world. Maybe I'll stop there and let Dave respond.
Dave?
Well, tagging on to certainly one of the themes you raised, Joel, that I'd want to hit, but maybe in different terms a little bit, I would call it breaking our isolation. You called it, you know, getting more information. I don't think that the people in our society are apathetic. I think we're isolated. And I think that North Americans, to the extent that we get in touch with the situation, really empathize. And that's why, you run into the same question that I run into all the time. Somebody says, well, you know, what can we do now? As soon as we get in touch with the situation, we want to respond. And I think one of the best things we can do is to continue working on undermining that isolation. And although it's a little depressing at times, I know it can be done in an energizing way. I have seen people for whom it is energizing. It's energizing to me to read 25 minutes a week a little newspaper on Africa that doesn't write editorials and doesn't give me a lot of political rhetoric, that's published in this country. There aren't many people that are more critical of our media than I am, I mean the popular media. But at the same time, I have to say that I think that nowhere in the world is there the availability of information that we have, well, let's not say availability, the existence of information that we do in this country, whether it's on Latin America or Southeast Asia or Africa. We can get information here that people can't get anywhere else in the world. It's not delivered on our, it's not the mainline media. I'd be very critical of that, but there's good stuff around. And I'm going to just pass this around the room because I think so strongly that it's an example of how we can break our isolation in a really energizing way that makes you feel liberated because we've gotten somewhere. Another theme I'd want to point to is I'd call democratic opportunities. Having lived in a police state where one doesn't have to do much speculating about whether mail is being read or telephones are being tapped or, you know, the reality that civil liberties can be cut off at any time real quickly, and that they do, and seeing that happen to other people, even seeing friends you know, beaten to death in prison, I have a very high respect for what opportunities we enjoy in this country to be democratic. And I'd say that a tremendous opportunity that we have is to exercise that democratic really responsibility. Oh yeah, and one just as one concrete example, and we could spend a whole session talking about how to exercise our democratic responsibilities vis-a-vis Latin America or Africa, but let me give you just one example. I think one of the problems with U.S. policy towards Namibia is that very few elected officials who go to Washington have ever been asked by any of their constituents where they stand on Southern Africa, or especially on Namibia, until they get to Washington. Nobody in the course of a campaign ever asks them, what's your position on Namibia? They ask all kinds of questions about, you know, their positions on economic issues and issues that we feel are part of our self-interest, but we never ask them where they stand on Namibia, with the result that they go to Washington, D.C., where there are highly paid lobbies by the South Africans for Namibians. And when those special interest groups start lobbying our elected officials, the officials say, well, my constituents have never asked me about this issue, so I know that they don't care about it. And the lobbyists provide a very seductive rationale that our congresspeople buy. So one example, I think, that any of us can do, whether you never spend another minute thinking about Namibia after you leave Holden Village, you can ask candidates in the elections coming up next year where they stand on Namibia, so that they will know, so that they're forced to come up with a position and be public about it before they go to Washington and we lose track of them. And also so that when they go to Washington and someone starts lobbying for a certain vote on Southern Africa, they will know that somebody back home cares. And I think, well, you already know how I feel about the Christian connection that we have and that should motivate us to do that. Thirdly, and I've only got four, I agree with Joel that we can do things that I call support. Support for people who are getting a lousy deal. Scandinavian Lutherans have given tremendous support to SWAPO, the movement of guerrillas who are fighting for independence in Namibia. Our newspapers never mention SWAPO without saying that they are Soviet-backed, nor do they ever mention that they are Scandinavian-backed. And there's evidence to suggest that the Scandinavians are much more active in actually offering support, whereas the Soviets are making a buck. You know, they have an armaments industry that they have to sell their arms, and they need markets. And so they sell arms to SWAPO. They don't give them, they sell them. The Scandinavians give aid to SWAPO, and we can do the same thing. In Seattle, we've just kicked off a drive to collect books for refugee camps, and you can't believe how easy it is to do. SWAPO has asked the American people for English dictionaries, because they say that English will be the official language of the country once they get independent, and that students at the moment in the refugee camps are sharing one English dictionary among 75 students. So they said, give us books. And we've got a little campaign going to collect used textbooks and used dictionaries. And I'm amazed at how easy it's going to be to send those to refugee camps. Namibia. Now, that's not going to solve all the problems in Namibia, but it's going to give us a connection. There are people in Seattle who are going to get a connection with Namibia that's going to energize them and is going to draw them into the issue, and that I think is an option that rich Christians have, and that we ought to do more in the way of exploiting. It's just one little example. Fourthly, and this is the one that I would be most careful about, is travel. We have tremendous travel opportunities. I think that more often than not, that's a debilitating factor than an enabling factor, that people who travel tend to come back as experts, and really, I've heard a lot of people who travel to South Africa with whom I have grave concerns about the sort of perspectives that they bring back. But nevertheless, those reservations in mind, it is an opportunity that rich Christians have, is to go and meet those people on those terms. But the last part of that phrase is the most important, on their terms. And language is part of terminology. And until we learn languages, we ought not think we've met people. But it is an opportunity. And I know every time I come up to Holden, I meet people who are thinking about it, you know, maybe I should go to Zimbabwe for a couple of years or something like that. Do it.
I'd like to add just one thing, if I could, Art. And that is that if once people begin to make some new choices about ways they're going to live their life, be it to choose a simpler lifestyle, be it to be more critical of some dimension of U.S. foreign policy, to act in a way that really enters into solidarity with those who suffer in the world, that sometimes means one begins to move against the main flow of our own culture. What that means is often is that people start to feel isolation and loneliness. And so that I think one of the critical ingredients also is to begin to discover and to form confessional communities in which one can discover and find the support for the kind of lifestyles we're talking about here. A community of faith, if you will, for Christians at least, that helps to give strength and support and encouragement and courage to stay with our new learnings, our new commitments.
Okay, thanks. Let's just toss it out to the crowd here at this point. Who'd like to jump in with a comment?
Well, I feel all kinds of energy when I bring myself to an isolated place like Holden. And I feel very isolationist when I'm up here in terms of the kinds of energy that comes from the ideas that are exchanged and the kind of commitment that I feel. But when I go back, I'm going to enter a predominant culture that is numb, that is paralyzed. And it seems when you know, if that assumption, based on my observation and my ministry, and the community is at least partially true, then I'm going to meet a community that is also hopeless. I'm going to meet a community that is not going to be able to identify with the folks in Namibia and in Latin America because they are hopeless. They have no need because they are numb. They have no need to hope. And you can beat your head up against a wall and try to energize a people, try to instill some commitment and authentic Christian stewardship of resources. But until those people are somehow, that dominant mentality of the culture is somehow shaken, is dismantled, is brought to a state of death, and I'm not sure that we're going to have any more than a pocket of folks that, you know, follow through on an active commitment to a rationale. I mean, I guess I'm very, very pessimistic about the possibilities. I'm not so sure I agree with David that there isn't apathy in the church. I think the church is complicit in secularism, and I think the church's ministry and the church's proclamation of the gospel is compromised, you know, by that that affluence. And until it recognizes that that isn't the salvation that they're looking for, that's going to save them. They're not going to take that dominant culture, which the church has co-opted, is not going to take an active interest in the poor. I just feel that as a real gut feeling.
Okay, thank you.
This sort of fits in with that, but I was sitting here thinking, we almost have to back up from the assumption that we realize we are rich. I think there are many Americans and many Christians, we look up at somebody that's richer. I look, well, they've got more money than we've got. We're looking at those that are richer than ourselves rather than those that are poorer than ourselves. I think in the American situation today, particularly with the economy, you can always find somebody that has more than we have. And that's our focus,
I think. And that's part of our isolation, I think, that Dave was talking about, too. Maybe you're right, stepping back to that recognition of how wealthy, I don't mean in real materialistic terms, we are in comparison with the rest of the world. You may be right that we have to somehow even get to that realization.
You just asked the question, for most people in the world looking at us right now in this room or here at Holden Village, you know, how would they regard us on the scale of poverty and affluence? We are obviously enormously rich by comparison.
Well, I'd like to respond a little bit to the pessimism.
All right. Now a word from the optimists.
I think I've been through a lot of changes in how I think people can be affected and changed and energized. And when I first got politicized and radicalized, which was almost an instantaneous event, I came back and I was going to do that to everybody else. Because that's how it happened for me. I thought that's how it had to happen for everybody. And then I found out people weren't listening to me. Because I wasn't talking to them. I was just talking what I wanted to hear. And I've had it really clearly brought home to me that the changes can happen incrementally, just tiny, tiny little steps. And I'm thinking specifically about my situation in Chelan, which is a very conservative, isolated little town, that we haven't turned the place on its ear, but there are a lot of issues that are being discussed there. People signing petitions, writing letters, listening to radio talk shows and things, on issues that they never would have considered before. And that was from a core of two of us that said, let's start a peace study action group a year and a half ago. And it's not a big deal, but I really think that those small, consistent workings with people particularly in that kind of either a small town or a neighborhood setting that you're going to keep seeing, you get credibility just as a human being with them. And then they're going to start to trust your views that come from faith commitment. And I've just seen a lot of progress made with people that if you had just said, this is what the gospel calls you to, please do it now, they wouldn't have understood and they wouldn't have been able to respond. So I offer that as encouragement. It's slow, but it
isolation is a mental attitude, I think. It's not necessarily a geographic reality as much as a mental attitude, and that's perhaps the kind of education that we who feel a strong sense of commitment, you know, need to work on, is the mental.
Another thought in terms of you talked about the people from your community being really hopeless. There's a sense in which the hopelessness of the rich is intimately linked to the hopelessness of the poor, and that it may be to start at the point of the hopelessness of those people. What is their hopelessness? What is their despair? What is their brokenness? And that becomes the starting point for ministry. And because I think there's the freedom we all seek comes together at some point. And it may be the starting point for the wealthy What are the roots of their hopelessness? Well, part of those roots may lie in their wealth.
Well, that amorphous mass, you know, which may not be a fair thing to say, that amorphous mass called community, the community out there, mm-hmm. is hopeless because they don't see a need to go beyond where they're at. That is, they have no vision for a better world.
One of the things we're struggling with here is how you get started. And what I heard over here, the peace talks in Chelan, two people getting together, drawing a parallel to industry. I just joined the management ranks of a corporation, and one issue they've been struggling with for the last 10 years is affirmative action. And a key issue around that is what they call a critical mass. And we're finally getting to the point in the corporation where we're reaching that critical mass of women in management ranks. And for a long time, it was building the support groups and getting two people together just to talk things through. And really, that's where I see our mission as rich Christians is to start off and crystallize that critical mass. Because mm-hmm. even if, you know, here it's very easy because we have that. We're all one big critical mass. But as we scatter back across the country in the next couple of weeks, it's going to be really tough. You go back into the isolationism. And if you can just somehow crystallize that with another person or by reading the African news or by getting the Bread for World newsletter, you know, that's what it takes.
Okay, who's next? Back here.
Just a couple of comments. I think maybe we need sometimes to link up with the wisdom of the scriptures and of people who've gone on before, who some of the people of the Bible spoke of things, all things are possible for those who believe. With God, nothing is impossible. There are still folk out there who believe that. I'm not speaking so much just right here, but there are folk out in the cities. Poor people still believe that. Lots of poor people believe that. And I think if we go out with the idea that try to carry through what we believe to be an important issue, I think we'll find other people who are brothers and sisters out there, people that we never thought or suspected would be interested. I think that they're out there, and we as individuals simply have to try to carry that kind of message. And I guess the other thing, I think it seems to me that the poor world that we're talking about is not just in Central America or Africa or other places. It's also in the United States. And when we talk about affirmative action, there are people who really need jobs in our country, black people, women. And I think we can all be a part of that if we're looking, you know, to do that. And maybe what we do is very small, but I don't think that should be much of a criterion for what we're trying to do. So I think there are instances where we can direct our energies, whether we consider ourselves rich or not. There are things that we have to share with people. And it seems to me that nothing else, we use the biblical wisdom that if we don't think we have any wisdom, that we need to get down and kneel and pray and ask God to show us what is that we're supposed to be doing, or what am I supposed to be doing with my money, with my wealth. I think God answers that kind of prayer, the Bible says.
Okay.
I have a question for the group. We're talking about paying attention to problems in Central America, Nicaragua, Honduras. We're talking about problems in Africa. We're talking about the threat of the bomb. We're talking about many, many political, social problems. As most of us return to our jobs in the world, in the different cities we come from, are we to be preaching politics to people, or are we supposed to be out there preaching the gospel? Kind of like, where's our focus supposed to be as Christians? So I can only be fragmented in so many ways, and if I
think about all the things I need to do, I think I'm going to either get become schizophrenic or lost, and I for one would like to suggest that maybe what I really need to do is to continue to focus on the gospel.
Okay, I appreciate that comment very much, and I think maybe this will trigger some variety of responses.
I think this is the place where we need to listen to Joel and David's advice when they call on us to listen to our Christian brothers and sisters throughout the world, and where we ask them, what should our focus be as we talk about and live the gospel? And that seems to be coming back to me very clearly from all parts of the world, except for certain sections of white North America, that the focus of the gospel isn't an apolitical thing. It's a very political thing that deals with liberation and justice. And if we confine the gospel to otherworldly spiritual ideas, then we are just treading over our Christians and brothers and sisters all over the world, and we're not listening to them at all, and we're denying the work of the Holy Spirit in those churches.
All right, who else would like to jump in on this one?
This brings us to John Frame's Bible study about being in Christ, the new creation, which is really the new world, where we have to be active in. It's not a new creation in our own self, in our own inner being. It's a creation we participate in extending our love to our neighbor. So I think we have to be political. It's not apolitical. Religion is never apolitical. It's an act of creation.
Yeah, I don't know.
I guess I don't know why helping people, for instance, and preaching the gospel are mutually exclusive. For someone like me, for instance, I'm no good at knocking on doors and saying, I love Jesus, you should too. I can't do that. But I can write letters, I can lobby corporations or something like that much more easily. And I guess that we take whatever strengths we have and whatever talents we have and use them best we can. Maybe he's better preaching the gospel. I'm better at writing letters.
Why can we see the connection between the two? That maybe is a key question.
There are consequences to our faith in the gospel. I think that's what Mary is talking about, among others. There's a Nebraska farm boy who's been a hero of mine for years, who in his American missions work for the old ALC said, a mission field is any area of life where the redemptive purposes of Jesus Christ have not been fulfilled. A mission field is any area of life. Personal, corporate, community, national, political, anything, where the redemptive purposes of Jesus Christ have not been fulfilled. And in answer to the question behind us, we simply have to ask our Lord to decide on which to focus we, in our particular settings, can best do. We can't get them all. But true accomplishment. The old gospel preachers who said, try to determine where the Holy Spirit is working, and then get in there.
Okay. All right, who's next?
Somebody else I've talked before.
Oh, it's sort of a following along line of reasoning. I think it could be very easy to get schizophrenic in this our society and world, because the problems we face increasingly seem to be more and more complex. And we increasingly, because of communication, see more and more of the problems than we ever had before. So I would agree. I think there's a sense. I didn't get the impression that you were the person back in the back was necessarily separating the gospel from political message. I don't think that can be done, but I do think that we as individuals need to try to fit in at one point. And as a Christian community, there is our strength because we're each fitting at different points in this world in our ministry and mission. Just a different point, because at least in my experience, we can
get almost, we can get that hopeless feeling when we're trying to approach the problem from 2,500 different places. And as we lose our vision of what God is doing,
okay.
He's holding his hand up for me. I agree with your point. I believe for myself that I often lack a vision. When I feel as a part of the community, I feel hopeless. And I suspect that there is an affluent poverty that brings us to that hopelessness. But also in my understanding of the theology of the cross, it is in our greatest hopelessness that we come to meet our God. And if we think that because we are affluent, that in some way separates us from the meeting of our God, then we are not hopeless enough.
We're thinking. Yeah, please.
A moment of great liberation for me was when a black man in South Africa said to me, you know, yeah, you white people are always trying to save the world. And you have made great contributions to the history of the world. And maybe now it's time for you to let somebody else design some solutions. And that was liberating to me, to feel that I don't have to come up with the solutions anymore.
All right, I'll recognize the hands that haven't had a chance to wave before. There are a couple of people who have spoken who would like to speak again, and that's fine too. Here we go.
I have three comments here. One is that it should be very easy to do something about all the things that we're talking about, and that is we should send everybody to home. I would like to ask the person who has been labeled a pessimist what he does when he goes back. I mean, what...
I'm a clergyman.
I would like
that to... That accounts for his pessimism.
I have one other comment. That is to the person who mentioned that he was close to being a schizophrenic.
Probably another clergyman.
I'd like to do a redirect on the gentleman's hearing. In religion, I think, and I think the gospel is often misrepresented as religion, it is easy to say that you can please the Maker, or Jesus in this case, by praying, by reading a book which has been idolized, in my opinion, by singing, and I think it was Dr. Rognes who told me years ago that God would say, I have pretty good choirs up here myself. Such things, and then to be fragmented, as you mentioned, by someone like Jesus, who said, I was hungry and you fed me, I was in jail and you visited me, I was sick. And I think that's where we stand.
Here, we've got a hand that's new. I'm going to start with.
One thing that comes to mind in the business of what can we do, and this is more along the lines of pet peeve, perhaps the general decision. We spend so much time in the congregation with which I've been associated being about the business of religion. and not at all enough time being about the business of Christianity. We meet, we discuss, we argue, we decide, we keep the doors open, and do all of the mechanical day-to-day things we carry over from our business world associations. A year and a half or so ago, we had the pleasant and uplifting challenge to sponsor a refugee family from South Sea. And it was, of course, an entirely new thing, and a very threatening thing to a lot of people in the congregation. Until we got to the point where we actually decided to do it. And at that point, a metamorphosis of sorts took place. And many of us who viewed that as a very real risk found the challenge instead. And not having experience in that business, of course, we did the best we could with what we had and made that happen to a family that was, and still is, very grateful to us. And who in that points out our wealth to us in multiple ways. I don't know that there's a solution there, but in fact, he is the time we spend in the business of religion.
My brother likes to use the illustration of a congregation that discovers there's some kids have broken the window. Now, does the congregation care more about the kids or about the broken window? Too often we our focus is on the broken window. All right, back to the optimist here.
Well, somewhere back there, I guess even just now, we were talking about where do we start? I mean, that's always a question. Was it Joel's comment? We never like the answers. That's why we keep asking the question. I think the answer is just anywhere. Just start somewhere. Don't expect to be right the first time you try something. Don't expect to be effective. Don't expect anything. Just do something. That's how I started in. I was originally involved with World Hunger, and then I've sort of gotten sidetracked on the nuclear arms issue. But on both of them, just do something somewhere, and the rest will grow from the support group that you're in. But also, another comment is the fragmentation question. Well, that's a good one. I mean, I think a lot of people struggle with that because we only have so much time and so much energy. But for me, I don't know what it means to preach the gospel separate from political, economic, social issues. I just don't know what it means. Okay, as a Neo-Lutheran, I'm actually a Methodist, but I've been here a while. I know the gospel is salvation, let's see if I can say it, salvation by grace through faith.
Rush her off to confirmation.
The gates are swinging open.
Okay, that's the gospel. But what does that mean? Does that mean that when we die we go to heaven? No, it doesn't. It means that we are promised life abundantly right here and right now. And everybody else is promised life abundantly right here and right now. And that life is physical, spiritual, emotional, and everything else. And I have discovered that my political action, I'm really drawn to that, to change the systems, to write letters and demonstrate and do all that kind of thing. I have to do that. But more and more, and particularly since I've seen the film Gandhi, that has had a tremendous effect on me, that in my everyday relationships, I have to be a peacemaker also, and a nurturer also. That you can do it all. I really believe that. I mean, you have to pick your issues. You can't do political action on every single issue that there is. Sometimes do world hunger and the arms race. And I hopefully, prayerfully, can also find time to love whoever I run into and deal with them lovingly. And I think it can be done.
Thanks. I shouldn't be saying anything here, but I can't resist. One of my contentions is that Lutherans tend to, like lots of other people, I guess, pick their passages in somewhat in isolation. Your comment picked on one of my favorites, Ephesians 2, 8 to 10. By grace you are saved through faith. This is the gift of God, not of works, lest anyone should boast. And we stop right there. But the next verse goes on to say, for we are his workmanship, created in Christ Jesus for good works, which God prepared beforehand that we should walk in. And we say the first part, we forget the part that follows. All right, back here. You waited a long time.
Okay, I feel like we're on a roll here. I'd like to make these comments in remembrance of Larry's morning Bible study with Woody Allen in the back of my mind. The lady who's been named the optimist, I'd like to suggest renaming her Golda Meir. Not only my dad, I think that's beautiful.
My name is Holly, by the way.
I'd like to rename the pessimist to the realist. I really think that when we're out there, your name, sir?
Lynn.
Okay.
Yeah.
I met you earlier, right?
Yes.
See, we got Lynn realist now. When we're out there, to keep in mind what we feel and what we believe, and to actually put it into practice, I don't know how realistic all of it is. Yes, as the lady over here suggested, we can and we should write our congressman. I certainly buy a lot of that program that I'm hearing suggested here. It's valid, no question about it. Gentlemen upstairs, I did not say I was schizophrenic. Quite redirect. Minor point. The question for me in my mind is, when I'm out there in the business world, and by the way, I'm not a pastor. I happen to manage a few people in the computer industry. My office is in San Francisco, and as far as affirmative action is concerned for the new manager, I've got lots of minorities working for me. I meet all corporate goals, and that's in the category of DFD. There's all kinds of programs. You hire the right people, you hire good people. If you do what's right, and if you're really true to that, it can work. My problem for myself is when I meet somebody, and when I get an opening to talk freely about my feeling, it doesn't happen often that I feel strong enough to let the person know what my feelings are. I feel as a Christian, if I'm talking to a non-Christian, it's very important for me to tell him who is Jesus Christ. If I get an opening that leads into that situation, that's going to be the key point for me to communicate one-on-one. Now, I feel I'm very ineffective at that task. It's rare that I feel bold enough to sit down with a business associate and start telling him or her about the fact that Christ died on the cross for the forgiveness of your sins. That's not normally done in the business world. And for me to put my energies into that program, which is a responsibility as a Christian, is tantamount. I've got to learn how to do that. And, a lot of the discussions of the problems in the different countries we've mentioned are all valid. One can debate fine points. But certainly the concept of our Christianity and politics together is valid. But what can I do one-on-one in communicating with people? Can I go ahead and tell them about South African countries and expect to also be sufficiently bold to get across the message of the gospel? The question comes back to what I call a reality situation. Now, have you heard the pot enough?
I'm violating my rule here. Sometimes we're tempted beyond what we're able to. I'm comfortable with that, and I think everybody has a bit of a different vocation here. We need to respect that. I'm reminded of a talk I heard years back by the late D.T. Niles, who was a missionary from at that time Ceylon, now Sri Lanka. point he made was that Christians are converted twice. First, they're converted from the world to Jesus Christ, and then they are converted back to the world again. Not in the same way, but to see the world now through the heart and mind of Christ. And I think maybe that's another way of saying we can link these things, we can integrate them. Yeah.
Okay. I'd like to come back to what David said quite a while ago, that as Christians we're called to many things, but we're not necessarily called to save the world. And as we're asking the question, where do we start, I'm hearing a lot of people saying things that sound a lot to me like, where do we start in order to save the world still? And this is, it's coming through as we talk about how do we convert the people in our congregation, how do we convert the people we work with, how do we convert them to Christianity, how do we convert them to a new political viewpoint, how do we change all the other people now that we're fine? And I personally am not completely converted yet. I'm not at a point where I'm worthy to save the world. And for me, it's a matter of, if I'm not going to save the world, at least I have to get out of the way myself before I start doing all these positive things to get everyone else to do the right things. I have to get out of the way myself of all the problems, and I have to acknowledge in myself all of my complicities in the injustice all over the world, in the spread of sin all over the world, and I have to attack those complicities in myself. And it's been a real struggle for me coming to grips with the very direct ways that I contribute to the problems of hunger and war and all these, and racism, sexism. When I find these things in myself, that's when the real struggle begins for me. If I can just get out of the way, if I can be a little less racist myself, if I can use the Earth's resources in just a little bit less of a wasteful manner, that's a step. If I can do that in myself, I think I need to start there before I start saving the world and saving my neighbors and getting everyone to do the same thing as me. I have to be doing something a little, get out of the way myself.
Okay, you're getting a little personal there, but I appreciate that. It's 9:55. We've got 5 minutes left. I just flagged that, so those who wish to speak can speak very quickly into the point, and those who feel you've got something really urgent to say, you know you've got to get in line fast. Okay, who is over here? Did I see him? Please.
I was just saying, on ideas of things to do, we have a very small congregation where we worship, which is half black and half white, and we had, just for a starter, in January, intergenerational Sunday school. And one Sunday we had the film on Namibia, and we wrote letters after that, and the people signed them. Another Sunday we talked about the whole peace issue. And we wrote even to Andropov, as well as Reagan and Senator Jackson, who's not exactly a dove. And, you know, we sent letters, and we got answers back from everybody except Andropov. And so, I mean, we are a very small congregation, but it's something you can do anyway. And I think, again, that was mentioned, the poor people in America, and many of our people in our church are poor people, are still interested in many of the same issues, and are certainly feel a very, at least our black members feel a real affinity with their Lutheran brothers and sisters in Namibia, which, unfortunately, unless somebody in the church brings it to their attention, they don't even know about. So I think we need to keep putting the issues in front of our people, however we can do it. Maybe Sunday school one way, I don't know.
Okay. Real quickly here, okay? 30 seconds.
One of the hopeful signs, were you not pointing to me?
Yes, I was.
I'm sorry.
It's a pessimist.
I can't be hopeful.
Real. My comment relates to the singing that was mentioned up here, and then to the idea of being labeled as a realist. And I, you know, very quickly, it's been said before, Scripture makes it very clear, and authors have extrapolated on the idea that it's pretty difficult, you know, to sing a new song in a strange land. Isn't that how it goes? I think it's awfully difficult to sing a new song in a strange land, and I think that's what the prophet today faces in North American affluent culture. Singing the new song, which is
the Lucan theme of poverty and riches. That kind of an alternate consciousness, that kind of an alternate countercultural lifestyle is really a new song, and a strange land isn't going to hear that. The hopeful sign is that we're still singing. As soon as we stop singing, then I think we're dead. The second thing is that I think you have to be a lunatic and not a realist. You have to be somewhat a Jeremiah type, I think, to be able to effectively administer that kind of a gospel. Because if you're a total realist, then it's too easy to become absorbed in the dominant mentality of a culture if you're a realist. So you've got to kind of step aside, and to do that, you kind of got to be a little bit...
I saw him back here.
Eccentric, yeah, off-center.
All right. Is that your neighbor?
I just thought that across the way when she spoke about the congregation half black and half white was as close as we've gotten to the answer. I think the key is for us all, in whatever ways is possible, wherever we are, to be as inclusive in our communities as we can. Because we do live in a pluralist society. We do live in a society that, even though we're predominantly rich, nonetheless mirrors the wider world. And if we can, wherever we are, cross the socioeconomic, class, race, sexual lines in genuine communication, that already the microcosmic picture of something which is the larger reality. Usually that happens most effectively by friendship. But it also happens by people's skills. I mean, one person knows how to be a carpenter and someone else needs that kind of skill. The variety of gifts that people have are gifts that already cross those lines when it comes to exchanging gifts. And I just think the inclusiveness is what it's about. And you cited Ephesians earlier. Happens in Ephesians, which I think is so poignant there, is that peacemaking is through the cross by breaking down the barriers that put people at enmity with one another. That is, and a new humanity is formed by crossing those lines. That is peacemaking through the cross. The context in which we live is one which we also ought to affirm. Yes, we're complicit in an enormous way in terrible issues around the world. At the same time, and this is underlining what Dave was saying earlier, in a democratic society, there is room to make new spaces. And we've got all kinds of latitude for the creation of community across lines that reflect the lines of the world.